Bush administration's theory that the president has the right to break the law is a theory which cannot hold water. Never before in the history of America has an administration in power said it had the power to break the law.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Today's guest bears the proud name of those of us who used to like to go to the toy store after the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, F.A.O. Schwartz. Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. is an attorney in New York. He was a magna cum laude graduate of both Harvard University and of the Harvard Law School, where he was an editor of the Law Review. He engaged in private practice of law with the firm of Cravath, Swain & Moore as a litigator beginning in 1969, but he did not hesitate on several occasions to answer the call for public service. Importantly, he served as chief counsel to the Senate Select Committee to study government operations with respect to intelligence activity, also known as the Church Committee, in 1975 and 1976. Later, he served as chairman of the commission that revised New York City's charter. Now he serves as senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. His recent book, which he co-wrote with Aziz S. Hugg, is Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Please welcome Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr.
Thank you, George. I always call myself Fritz, and when Fritz Mondale, who was on the Church Committee, and I were on a program recently, and I told him, you know, Fritz, the only reason you didn't win against Ronald Reagan is because you ran as Walter instead of as Fritz. he laughed appropriately. So I'd like to cover two things in this talk. First, I want to talk a little bit about the book, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, Unchecked and Unbalanced. And second, I want to talk a little bit about trends that make more difficult the restraining of presidential power today, I think, than ever before. The book, the title of the book, Unchecked and Unbalanced, delivers a message, because the message is, if any element of government, in the executive perhaps particularly, is unchecked, it is likely to be unbalanced. And that has been the story of the Bush administration, that dispensing with checks, resisting checks, seeking to eliminate checks, have led to a number of errors, that have been harmful to our country and actually harmful to the battle against terrorism, in the name of which the checks have been pushed aside. Now, the book has three parts. The first is historical, and I'll talk about that part. And then the second is about subjects like torture and extraordinary rendition. And the third is about the theory which has led to the Bush administration's carrying far beyond what has ever been done before. The theory of presidential power. History teaches us, American history particularly teaches us, but world history does too, that if you have crisis, at the time of crisis, it is tempting to forget about the wise restraints that keep us free. That has been true. It was true at the time of the Alien and Sedition Act in 1800. Lincoln is a special case that I could talk about later, but it was true after the First World War with the Palmer Raids. It was true during World War II, when Franklin Roosevelt locked up 117,000 Japanese American in concentration camps on the West Coast. And it was true during the Cold War, which was the activity that the Church Committee particularly studied, 30 years of Cold War, leading up to our reports in 1975 and 1976. Now, The Cold War was a little bit different than the earlier historical examples that I illustrated, in that the earlier ones, the actions by administrations were known to the public when they were being taken. During the Cold War, the actions were secret, and what was being done by the FBI and the CIA and the NSA, National Security Agency, which most people had indeed never heard of, was not known to the public. That was an important difference. Now, of course, the kind of conduct that took place, I could give a couple of examples. And the FBI, the effort to actually get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, which they did, tried to do. The CIA, the hiring of the mafia, the Chicago heads of the mafia to try and assist in the effort to kill Fidel Castro, or the effort, successful effort, to overthrow the democratically elected government of Chile, leading to the assassination of, or suicide of Salvador Allende. So those are examples of CIA and FBI conduct, but there were many things that affected smaller people just as well as the Fidel Castro or Martin Luther King. And why did those events happen? What were the causes of the what made the government able to do what it did do? Most importantly, it's a combination of secrecy and lack of oversight. If you have secrecy and you have lack of oversight, you are extremely likely to have abuse. Coupled with that, you'd add vague laws. There were essentially no laws governing the FBI and the CIA and the NSA. There were the vaguest of standards, which Franklin Roosevelt, unfortunately, to his image, which was largely great, set in motion for the FBI by unleashing J. Edgar Hoover to investigate what were called subversives, a word that has no content and which led to, for example, ultimately such important national security objectives as infiltrating the women's liberation movement as a danger, subversive danger to our nation. So vague laws, instructions from presidents that were themselves vague, winks and nods which suggested misconduct without ever using words that could be thrust back at the chief executive. Then you had a phenomenon that we called mission creep. And this is important to remember because it's true today as well. When you start something that sounds as if it's legitimate, it tends, when there's no oversight and when there's secrecy, to widen out into something which is clearly illegitimate. I'll give two examples of that. One would be the NSA, National Security Agency, this powerful, technologically exalted, wonderful agency that's able to do marvelous, magical things of sucking information out of the air. They got, starting in 1946 and running for 30 years, every single telegram that left the United States, every single one, was given to the NSA. Now, why did that start and how did it develop? Well, it started because the NSA wanted to be sure that they got every copy of an encrypted, that is, in code, communication that was sent by a foreign embassy or another foreign person to the home country overseas. No, that doesn't sound so bad. It isn't so bad. Why shouldn't we find out what foreign nations are saying? It's done by others to us, and so it's sort of part of the culture that everybody thinks is appropriate. But that's the way it started. And then as it developed, the NSA was looking into civil rights leaders' communications with foreigners and anti-Vietnam War protesters' communications going outside the United States. So something that started with a narrow and relatively legitimate objective became a much broader and illegitimate conduct. The other thing was the FBI's COINTELPRO program, counterintelligence program. which was a program where the nation's chief law enforcement agency turned not to enforcing the law, but to disrupting people they thought were bad, trying to destroy them. That's the kind of thing that leads to the effort to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide. But it started, again, relatively narrowly. It started focused on the Communist Party of the United States. Now, they started because they felt the courts were not being tough enough. The Supreme Court had decided some decisions that let the FBI to say, well, the law isn't going to work for us. We got to take the law into our own hands. But it started with the Communist Party. But it ends up with groups like the Women's Liberation Movement and the Students for a Democratic Society and black organizations. Language, of course, was polluted. Language is always being polluted. And George Orwell taught us that pretty well. And for example, Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, leaders in the battle for civil rights at 100 years after the Civil War, what did the FBI call them? Black nationalist hate group. Words are dangerous, and words like subversive and national security, the church committee concluded, are used constantly to cover for conduct which cannot be defended once it sees the light of day. So anyway, that's the history part of the book, which is Unchecked and Unbalanced, which is maybe 10 or 15%. We then go on with a bunch of chapters that are called Adopting Tactics of the Enemy, and talk there about tactics. This is all now the Bush administration. Talk about tactics that we have used since 9/11, which are tactics of the enemy. They are things which are not part of our culture. They are things that are not part of the American government of laws and not of men or women. The torture, which we have used, extraordinary rendition, which is sending people to foreign countries for the purpose of their being tortured, and I want to come back to that in a minute, and then the use of indefinite detention on the presidential say-so and warrantless wiretapping within the United States. A rendition is a particularly good example of a tactic which is not consistent with our values and which cannot be defended. Rendition is the sending of people who have been grabbed by Americans, sometimes at Kennedy Airport, as a Canadian citizen was sent to Syria, sometimes in Italy, as a particular person was seized on the streets of Italy and then sent to Egypt, leading eventually to the indictment by the Italian government of 11 or 13 CIA officials for having done this kidnapping. Now, these people are sent to countries like Syria and Egypt and also Jordan. They're sent to countries which our State Department each year denounces for their regular practice of torturing their prisoners. They're sent to those countries for the purpose of their being tortured. Now, President Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice say, oh, even though the State Department condemns them every year for using torture regularly, they've promised us they won't torture the people we send to them. Well, you know, that is simply not believable. And going down the route that we've taken is something that leads quite frequently to both our president and public officials like Secretary of State Rice making statements which are deceptive to be kind. The President Bush, similarly, in the 2004 campaign, twice said, oh, don't worry about the surveillance in the United States. We don't do any wiretapping unless we get a court order. Now, a year after that campaign, we learned from the New York Times that, in fact, since practically the day after 9/11, the National Security Agency had been wiretapping people without the court order that's required under the law called FISA that was passed in 1978. Now, why do these actions matter? Why aren't they defensible actions? Because they're carried out in the name of reducing our risk. Well, I think the best case, and we make the case in the book, Unchecked and Unbalanced, is that actually doing these things, like torture and extraordinary rendition and indefinite detention or disappearing people, actually hurts us in the effort to defeat the bin Ladens of the world. It hurts us in two ways. Way number one is that it causes our allies to lose faith in America. If you take the day after 9/11 in France, there's that great headline in the Paris newspaper in French, which I won't use despite my great education, which has left me as far as my French pronunciation goes. But the headline is, "We are all Americans now." Now, since that time, when we had this enormous reservoir of goodwill, clearly the respect for the United States among our allies has gone way down. You all know that when you travel, and we know it from surveys and polls that have been done across the world. The second thing that our engaging in the tactics of the enemy does to hurt us in the battle against the bin Ladens of the world is that it gives an enormous recruiting tool to the people who are against us. They use on their cell phones the images from Abu Ghraib, and they use those effectively. Now, of course, it's distorted because the tactics we are using are the tactics of the enemy. They're using them themselves. They do not have clean hands, but we should not have given that propaganda victory to the people who we are legitimately opposing. The third part of the book is titled The Constitution Turned Upside Down. Titles are interesting. When I did all the First Amendment work for Time, Inc., I concluded that titles of articles or photo captions or captions within a story give rise to 60 or 70% of the libel claims because they are often titles are carelessly done. Well, this title wasn't carelessly done because what we did is pick up on the song that the British supposedly played or did play when they were surrendering at Yorktown at the end of the Revolution, which was "The World Turned Upside Down." And the title of the third part of the book is "The Constitution Turned Upside Down." And in that, our effort is to show that the Bush administration's theory that the president has the right to break the law is inconsistent with, A, the language of the Constitution, B, our history, C, the debates about the ratification of the Constitution, D, the Supreme Court's analysis of the Constitution. It is a theory which cannot hold water, but it is the theory that this administration has voiced. Never before in the history of America has an administration in power said it had the power to break the law. This administration says it does. It can disregard the law. Now, President Nixon, after he had left office, told first the Church Committee and then David Frost that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal. But no administration in office has ever taken the position that the Bush administration has. So we try, and I think hopefully successfully do succeed, to show that the theory is just wrong and the theory is dangerous. Now let me switch a little bit to trends and theory and what's going on more generally, what has been going on more generally in our country that has allowed for the Bush administration's conduct and that should make one worried about what's going to happen in the future to our presidency and our democratic institutions. The theory of the American Constitution was best set forth by James Madison. But before talking about Madison, I want to compare the theory in America in 1776, at the time of the Declaration and the time of the Revolution, to the theory in 1787, when we write our Constitution. At the time of the Revolution, as expressed by Thomas Paine and many others, the theory was, once we shake off the shackles of the British crown, the essential goodness of the American people will mean that you do not need restraints on government. Well, the period between the Declaration and the Constitution, just that short time, proved to the founders that that theory was wrong, and that as James Madison said in the 51st Federalist, men are not angels, and there one would today say, nor are women angels. And I appreciate the little laughter that I get from one woman there anyway. So men are not angels, and because they're not angels, you must set ambition to counteract ambition. And that's why we have the checks and balances. That's why we have the Congress and the President sharing foreign affairs powers. Actually, the Congress in the Constitution is given more of them than the President is. So we have a theory, because men are not angels, you need a government with checks. Now, I want to jump fast forward to Lloyd Cutler, who I saw his picture as we were walking in here, and Lloyd was a great hero of mine, a lawyer older than me, was a great lawyer in Washington, and he served as White House counsel twice. But Lloyd, I think, was indicative of a wrong attitude, a dangerous attitude, when he was Carter's White House counsel. And he said, well, you know, it's clear that this whole idea of checks and balances doesn't work, and we should change to a government like the English government of today, where you have a prime minister and a Congress, or in their case, a parliament, who is essentially must do what the prime minister tells them to do. So he said, we should have a system where the president is able to tell the Congress what to do, and there isn't all of this debate and difficulty and effort to reach consensus before Congress will act. Then Ronald Reagan, shortly after Lloyd Cutler's comment, said when he took his inaugural speech, he said, well, the problem is the government. And actually Lloyd Cutler went way back, even though he didn't quote him, to Thomas Paine, and he said, all we have to do is unleash the goodness of America and we can get rid of all of these restraints that are built into our constitutional system. And at the same time, out in California, Howard Jarvis, with his Proposition 13, was pushing, and it has, particularly in our Western states, become more and more important since, the idea of direct democracy, where you get rid of the intervention of the Congress or the state legislature, and you have the people themselves vote on legislation. Of course, when that's done, as Proposition 13, eliminating taxes, basically, I mean, making it very hard for there to be taxes in California, shows, the public may seize on one little side of the balance and ignore the other side of the balance. And then you have, at around the same time, Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney is part of this same movement of trying to shake off what he would call the shackles built into our constitutional system. Because Cheney, way back in 1986 or 87, when he was in the Congress, voted against the Iran-Contra report that criticized the Reagan administration for selling missiles to Iran, and then using the money from the missiles, not putting it through the government budget, and avoiding a congressional law that said the American government may not finance a movement in Central America, the Contras, Iran, the Nicaraguan Contras. And they took the money and kept it out of the budget, and despite the congressional law, gave the money to the Contras. So the committee, bipartisan committee, wrote a report that was very critical of the Reagan administration in the Iran-Contra affair. Cheney dissented. And in his dissent, it's very, very interesting if you now look at it in light of what the Bush administration has done while Mr. Cheney was vice president. In his dissent, he said, first, it's okay to lie to Congress. Said Oliver North, lying to Congress is perfectly fine because Congress had no right to try and get the information that Oliver North lied about. But then even more interestingly, he says in that 1986 or 87 report that the president sometimes must seize monarchical powers. And actually, an American having inherited our revolution against the monarchy is asserting that our president is at times meant to be a monarch. Now, that, you know, nobody paid any attention to that when Cheney said it in the 80s, but once he became vice president and a very important figure in the administration, that became a driving part of the analysis and the advocacy of the Bush administration. Now, beyond those sort of historical points, I think there are two or three other things that we should talk about in thinking about how hard it's going to be to bring us back to acceptance of the checks and balances, including in that an effective Congress. One thing is sort of a political mechanical point, is the districting of drawing the lines of districts for state legislatures and for Congress has now become so sophisticated that it's done in a way that leads to safe districts being created for both Republicans and Democrats, so that 90% or so of the districts in Congress, for example, are essentially safe, and it's going to take a real cataclysm to have any contest in that 90%. The consequence of that is that you tend to have the decision, the only fight being in the nomination stage. And the consequence of that is that you tend to have people elected who are on the extreme end of both parties, conservative Republicans and highly liberal Democrats, and not the people who traditionally in the Congress, while of course they've been party members and of course they've cared about their parties, have been more toward the middle and more likely to seek to compromise. Of course, parties were not anticipated by the founding fathers and mothers, and the but of which there were none, but they but the parties, the existence of parties also makes it harder for there to be the role for Congress that was anticipated by the people who wrote the Constitution. Then I think another factor is simple impatience. We live in this instant culture where information is instantaneous and satisfaction is desired immediately. And I think that makes it harder for people to accept the system of checks and balances which is designed to make things deliberate. Then finally, I should be stopping in about 2 minutes or something like that. Yeah. Finally, I think the public needs to be educated better about the importance of the values in our Constitution. I think it's great to have Child Left Behind and such laws and such efforts to improve math scores and to improve reading ability. But if you don't educate the public about their civic responsibility, if you don't interest the public in their history, it's going to be much harder to have the public do what they need to do to press their congresspeople to do the right thing. And Benjamin Franklin, when he left the Constitutional Convention, was met by a woman on the street. And she said to him, "Well, doctor, what have you given us?" a republic or a monarchy? And Dr. Franklin's answer was, a republic if you can keep it. And of course, the you was not just that particular woman. It was everybody at that time, and everybody in every succeeding generation, and all of us in this room, and in the state of Virginia, and in the whole country. It's a republic if we can keep it. So thank you.
Fritz, I will sort of kick things off with a question based more on history than on what's going on today. When the Civil War was very much in doubt in early 1863, late 1862, Lincoln used what can only be described as questionable, if not highly dubious, means to arrange for the recognition of the breakaway sections of Virginia, that we now know as West Virginia, to be admitted to the Union. He was so concerned about the legality of what the procedure that he followed that he polled the members of his cabinet, and three thought it was legal and three thought it was extra legal. And so the decision was left to Lincoln. And he said, we can scarcely dispense with the aid of West Virginia in this struggle, much less can we afford to have her against us in Congress and in the field. The division of a state is dreaded as a precedent, but a measure made expedient by a war is no precedent for times of peace. I believe the admission of West Virginia is expedient. So he signed the act admitting West Virginia and picked up two additional votes in the Senate for things that he thought were necessary. This was an existential threat. And there have been other times of existential threat when presidents have gone well beyond what many think was lawful, and we can think of many examples of that. Are we in a time of existential threat now? Should there be different standards of tolerance for the amount of chalk that a president can get on their shoes?
Well, Civil War, certainly was as great a threat as our nation's ever faced. I think one should concede that at the moment of emergency, a president should grab the ball and should run with it and should do something. You know, on the morning of or the afternoon of 9/11, of course we should have organized responses. But as time goes on, it's no longer an emergency. It's important, but it's not an emergency in the same sense. And Lincoln has another lesson for us. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus at the beginning of the Civil War. The Southern troops were 20 miles from Washington, D.C., to the south. Northern troops were beginning to come down from the north to help defend the Capitol. They were coming through Baltimore, and as they came through Baltimore, they were assaulted, and 16 troops were killed as they were moving through Baltimore. The mayor of Baltimore said, I'm going to blow up the bridges so that no more troops can come down from the north. So Lincoln suspended habeas corpus and arrested some of those people. Now, the key difference between his conduct then and the kinds of things that have gone on since 9/11 is that Lincoln did what he did publicly, and he reported it to the Congress, and in effect said, well, I hope you're going to ratify what I did, because I think I did it for good reason. But if you don't, you can punish me. Now, that's a very, very different approach from the Bush-Cheney approach, which is to take actions and totally keep them secret. And so I think we should hold Lincoln up as a model for how to address emergencies and not as an excuse for what the Bush administration has been doing. Of course, my favorite Lincoln quote was the one where the cabinet was 9 on one side and he was the only one. He said, the vote is 9-1 and the nays have it, or the one has it.
I have a perception that the Supreme Court has tended to drag its feet in dealing with these issues. It is, although it has passed some reminders or legislation, but I think that they've been reluctant to do so. Is this perception correct in your mind?
Do what?
Is this perception correct that the Supreme Court has been dragging its feet and is somewhat reluctant to deal with these issues?
I think historically it is true that the Supreme Court has, during wartime, been very reluctant to intervene. After the Civil War, they actually issued a decision that said Lincoln had been wrong on habeas corpus. During World War II, the Korematsu decision upheld the internment of the Japanese, although almost every one of the judges who joined that decision later said they were unhappy that they'd done so. Actually, during this conflict, I think the Supreme Court has been more willing to jump in than in prior occasions. And I think probably the reason is that the Supreme Court here now got offended when they understood how radical the Bush administration's theory was. Because unlike Lincoln and unlike Franklin Roosevelt, the Bush administration has kept secret what they're doing and hasn't sought to get the Congress and the public to support them. So I think the Supreme Court this time in the last, since 2004 has been pretty good.
Hi, I'm Lisa Ahrens, and I'm a member of the community here. I was, in your effort to have people learn more about the Constitution, I'm going to ask you to teach me something about the Constitution. Maybe it's too large, it's a very large issue. What are the war powers? What are the emergency powers that are expressed in the Constitution?
The Constitution's pretty silent about emergencies. The one place where it speaks directly to the subject actually stands strongly against what the Bush administration has done. And that's in Article 1. That's the article that describes the Congress. There's a provision for the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. And it says during times of rebellion or invasion, the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended. And everybody believes that means suspended by the Congress. Now, the Bush administration has, in essence, taken the position that they alone can decide to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. I've got a footnote to that in a minute. But they alone can decide to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, and it can be done even though there is neither an invasion nor a rebellion. Now, there's a threat, but it's not an invasion or rebellion. Now, Congress, since the 2006 election, has been a little better on oversight, demanding answers, demanding information. But the Bush administration has very well succeeded in sort of rolling over the Congress in the bills, a couple of bills that were passed after the 2006 election. I think the fear is used very effectively. Fear is a powerful weapon in the hands of people who want to seize power. And Congress has not done a good job, in my judgment, substantively. I think they've been afraid to do it.
This is another fear question, and perhaps I'm a victim of that as well. And what I'd like to address is the question of torture. While I totally agree with your comments on torture and McCain's stance on torture and so forth, that little fear factor, I think, challenges all of us as we hear it in a lot of the political commentary and questions with the various groups on the debates, is what if, you know, what if you knew you had somebody that could tell you something how far would you play this game?
Yeah.
And I agree with your statements relevant to torture, but the thing I've never heard, and I was in the military for 30 years as a physician, so that took me out of the field, so I can't identify with McCain, but I have heard the discussions. And the question comes up is, do you ever really learn anything if you push that envelope? And maybe you can't answer the question, or maybe it's inappropriate. I just don't know. But I've never heard anything that would tell me if you learned anything.
It would be hard to assert you never can learn anything. I think the you'd have to say, do you learn more than you learn from other methods? And I just read in the paper yesterday about some people in their 90s who had interrogated high-level German officials who were captured in World War II, and particularly the person who was interrogating Rudolf Hess, who'd been, I think, Hitler's number two, and then it was captured in Scotland and for complicated reasons. But he said, I got much more out of him from playing ping pong and playing chess than I ever got from, and I didn't use the other methods. I think a lot of people say, well, suppose there's a ticking bomb and you know that person knows where the bomb is. The answer to that cannot be to have a law that says you can use torture. If there truly were such a situation, the answer would be sort of the Lincoln answer, you know, I did it, you can punish me, here's how I defend what I did. Now, the Iraq War isn't a big part of Unchecked and Unbalanced, but it's sort of there, and it's there in all of our minds. The second reason for going to war in Iraq, the first reason was the weapons of mass destruction, which turns out didn't exist. The second reason, and in some ways more powerful reason, was, well, Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda had cooperated with each other, and indeed the inference which Cheney always spewed in his speeches with careful language, but the inference was Saddam Hussein had been involved in 9/11. Now, they had one piece of evidence for that. There was a person who was a high-level al-Qaeda operative called al-Libi, who was sent to Egypt by rendition, was sent to Egypt for torture. And Mr. al-Libi, when he was tortured in Egypt, said, we, al-Qaeda, and Saddam Hussein were connected. And when Rumsfeld said he had absolute clear evidence, that's what he was relying on, and Bush and Cheney and Colin Powell all relied on that. Now, the problem was, before they relied on it, they'd been told by the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is one of the many intelligence agencies in the government, that Mr. al-Libi was totally unreliable and that the Germans, we knew he was unreliable, but nonetheless we relied on it. So I think the fruits of torture in a strange way contributed to the case made for war, which turned out so badly for us.
Fritz, it's wonderful to have you here. You've spent more than half of your life in public service, so I'm going to throw you a home run ball. Based on your experience, you've said that the public needs to be better educated on these issues. How can we get the public to become more involved in dealing with them, in engaging in public service? And, of course, at this marvelous university where we see students in each one of the schools preparing for what will certainly be important careers, trying to get more of them interested in public affairs is a very big thing.
Well, of course, it somewhat goes in cycles. I mean, when you and I were entering the world after college, I mean, we were heavily affected by the idealism that led to the Peace Corps, that led to Jack Kennedy saying, ask not what you can do for what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. We were growing up during the civil rights movement, so the atmosphere in the country makes a difference, and I think there are cycles in that. Arthur Schlesinger wrote that book about the cycles in American history on American politics on conservative, liberal, every 30 years or so going back and forth. I think it's also probably true there are cycles in interest in public interest. I know that when I speak to lawyers, young lawyers, one thing I say to them is, you know, there are many ways you can have a fine career. You can be in the public sector all your life. You can go from public to private. You can go from private to public. Or you can be in the private sector all your career. And I said, the only one that I think is a personal mistake, it's not an evil thing, but I think it's a mistake because you miss so much, is not being in the public sector at least some of your career. And people don't know, you know, there's a lot of chatter about government bureaucrats, and many government people are, you know, unfeeling and they, you know, behind the counter and they're difficult. But people who haven't been in government have no idea how many thoughtful, creative, energetic people there are that for much less pay than they could get in the private sector are doing wonderful things for our country. So I suppose the most important reason to want to be in the public sector a lot, or at least part of the time, is that it's extremely satisfying. The work is stimulating. Your colleagues are highly motivated and very intelligent, and you feel better.
My question is, what is the role of international accountability? I mean, clearly our allies have lost respect for us as a nation, but what does this mean in terms of practice and international politics?
Well, I think this is a big wrestling point in our country now. You know, what attention should we pay to international, just to take narrowly in the courts? When Justice Kennedy, in one of his opinions on either homosexual sex and whether that should be done in private, whether that should be made illegal, or on the death penalty for juveniles, and perhaps in both cases, referred to what other countries do. This caused an incredible ruckus, and people like Justice Scalia, Harvard Law School classmate, thought this was, you know, just beyond the pale. And the Bush administration, in their washing their hands of any kind of international consensus, I think contributed to the loss of our soft power. That good book by Joseph Nye, which is about American soft power is really important just as much as military power is. So I think the seeking, and there are other ways in which this administration has lost credibility in the world because it has taken an American exceptionalism position, and we have a wonderful country, and we should all believe that, and we should love our country, but we shouldn't believe we're always right, and we shouldn't believe we can ignore what other people think. And, for example, in the field of the environment, the Bush administration abandoning the Kyoto Principle and saying either they don't believe in global warming or they don't care about global warming, that was another terrible mistake. Our position on the death penalty is one which, you know, people can argue about that, but it surely hurts us. So the idea that we can, as a country, ignore the sentiments of the rest of the world is foolish from a human point of view and stupid from the point of view of actually having our own interests prevail and as opposed to doing things which undercut our position in the world. So I think you've put your finger on a really important point.
Our own Larry Sabato has recently completed a book, which I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read yet. But I believe he begins to lay the groundwork for a constitutional convention wherein he gives, I believe, 10 jump starts to what the constitutional convention might consider to improve the Constitution. Do you believe that there's any merit in such an idea?
I would be rather pragmatic about that, and I don't think now's the time to do it. I think we might take steps backward if we had a constitutional convention. That doesn't mean it's not an idea that never should happen. I would worry about it today. To jump off from your point a little bit and put something forward that isn't going to happen either, but you know, when we had our constitutional convention in 1787, we had it because there were 13 states, and they were all marching off in different directions. They were all putting tariffs up against the other, and they were acting in a selfish way that reduced the strength of the collective, reduced the e pluribus unum from many one. In a way, that's true of the world as an institution today. And picking up on the question that the prior questioner asked, I do think we need to find a way not to have world government. That's not going to happen either. But to have some greater coming together of the nations of the world than we've succeeded in having so far. And global warming is just a perfect example of that, because without us joining with China and India and the rest of the world, we're going to see the lives of our children and our grandchildren for the first time in human history knowingly be worse because of our conduct than our own lives have been. I don't know if that's enough of an answer, but I guess I'd like to be a little pragmatic, and I would worry today about having a new constitutional convention.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz, for an excellent presentation and for being at the Miller Center. I don't agree with everything Frank Rich says, but I agreed with most of what he said yesterday in the New York Times, because he really talked about cover-up, starting with mission accomplished. I'm sure you saw this. Starting with mission accomplished, then he talked about the fact that the law was passed by the Bush administration never to photograph corpses as they returned to America. I think he covered the Walter Reed issue, where no one ever talked about wounded soldiers. He certainly talked about the millions of refugees who've left Iraq that the Bush administration, the president, has finally said something about that. I think that about covered what he had to say, other than the fact that he finally talked about the number of Iraqis who've been killed.
You know, the headline in his piece was something like, I mean, I don't have it exactly, but this was the thrust of it: we're all good Germans now. And he was decrying a number of things the Bush administration has done, but he was saying, I mean, that headline conveys that we have to be, this gets back to Dr. Franklin's comment, we have to be more concerned and more outspoken as a public. I mean, take the presidential candidates running today. They're not being confronted on these issues as they ought to be. I mean, every one of them should be asked, if you were president, would you accept the theory that the president has the right to disregard laws of Congress? I mean, that's a nice small start. And we shouldn't think that this is only a Republican issue. It's not. Presidents like power. Presidents need power. And to be empathetic with presidents, their job is to prevent bad things from happening. So you've got to have some empathy with their wanting to stretch their powers. But where the ship has gone in the wrong direction is in assuming that by a small coterie of people in the executive branch, without public debate, without debate with Congress, without discussion, that you're more likely to have wise decisions. So all of human history teaches us that the smaller the number of people who are considering something, the more likely you're to have make a mistake. The recent book by Jack Goldsmith, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush administration, and then when he went into that job was shocked to find out what his predecessors, who were his personal good friends, had done. He has the thesis that the danger, the greatest danger of the Bush administration was their adamant philosophical refusal to bring into the debate the Congress and the people. And he describes how Franklin Roosevelt, when there were difficult issues as far as presidential power was concerned before we entered the war, when England was beset, almost about to be invaded by Hitler, when France had been overrun, and Roosevelt wanted to do things that were on the margin constitutionally, whether he could do them, Roosevelt very effectively brought in Republicans into his cabinet. He brought in a Secretary of War and Secretary of the Navy, Stimson and Knox, and he effectively had a public discussion in which ended up by Roosevelt getting most of what he wanted, whereas the Bush administration, and Cheney here I think is the intellectual origin of the error, adamantly believes that it's important for them to act alone, just for the sake of acting alone.
I'd like to ask the paranoia question, which I certainly have in my mind, and I think others do too. Our country is politically divided, and I must admit I'm greatly cheered by the recent congressional election, because I think a lot of people in the country, even nominal Republican conservatives, are really disenchanted with this administration. But my question of paranoia is, it's very hard, as Franklin said, to keep a democracy. There's going to be terrible temptation, especially in wartime, to go toward a dictator. And Mr. Cheney has shown a strong desire for presidential power in ignoring the Congress and the Supreme Court. So do you believe our system, if Mr. Cheney had the notion, especially with the army mostly out of the country, to overturn the 2008 presidential election? I think our system is strong enough to withstand that, but we have something called Blackwater. So again, this is the paranoia question. I don't think it would happen, but I think with the things you're talking about, it's not unfair to raise it.
Yeah, the person sitting in the White House can't overturn anything, actually, in a coup d'etat sense. And coup d'etats don't happen without the military. And I think the military, in general, during the last 6 years, has been good rather than bad. I mean, on the torture stuff, the military has been terrific in saying this is not right, it's harmful to our troops. Now, on the you could fault the military, I think, for only one of them, Shinseki, I think his name was, spoke up about the number of troops. But you can't have a coup d'etat without the military, and it's not going to happen here. Now, I'd like to make an analogy, though. This summer, I read a book on that covered the end of the Roman Republic, not the Roman Empire, but the Roman Republic. And what happened there was that there was corruption, and that was bad, that helped. But the main thing that led to the collapse was soldiers became loyal to their generals instead of loyal to the nation. Now, that I do not believe is a problem in the United States. But what is a problem is somewhat analogous, which is politicians in Congress have become loyal to their general or adamantly opposed, no matter what, to the general. Right now, it's the Republicans are automatically loyal to their general, and the Democrats are sort of more automatically opposed. And that isn't the way our government's meant to work. They're meant to be thinking outside the fealty to the president, and that's slipped, and that's something which we should seek to restore, and I gave some reasons why it's difficult to restore. But
in studying the prerogative powers of presidents of the United States, it seems like Lincoln has been the only one to successfully get away, so to speak, with breaking the rules for the greater good of the republic. What is it, in your opinion, about Lincoln, besides the nature of his crisis, that has allowed him to be seen in history's eyes as successful in breaking?
Well, I think the huge difference is that he was open about what he was doing, and persuaded certainly the Congress and I guess the public that what he had done was not to be chastised, but was to be accepted and ratified. And then Lincoln, you know, everybody looks at history through their own lens, and we, having grown up in the civil rights movement, as two of us did anyway, you know, have to look back on Lincoln through the lens of his accomplishing great things on the subject of race, maybe more slowly than could have been done. But so I was, you know, when one writes something, I didn't want to jump on Lincoln, and so maybe I hope I was honest in the book here in distinguishing Lincoln from George Bush. I think actually it's hard to use the two in the same sentence.
Mr. Schwartz, it's quite an exciting and interesting topic that you talked about. My question is, all these memos that are being written and sent out to the various troops, how binding are they? Are they with the next president or the next chief executive have to follow these? And if they do, and if they were wrong, do they set a precedence?
Well, the documents that were written by the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel are binding within the government until they are overruled. But I said I think the current candidates should be asked, do you accept the theory that the president has the right to break a law of Congress? And a new president hopefully is going to say, I do not accept that theory. So that's a great question to finish with. And I really thoroughly enjoyed being here with you at this great campus and this wonderful Miller Center. So thank you. Thank you.